from
Wondery.
Boston, Massachusetts, August 16, 1892. Last evening, I talked with a detective who has won for himself an enviable reputation in ferreting out criminal matters, and whose judgment on matters of this kind has been accepted by police officials. His services and time for the past 11 days have been busily occupied with a mysterious Borden murder case at Fall River, and until last Saturday evening, he has been on the scene, or within a few miles of the place, where the horrible double murder was perpetrated. Direct from the scene of the horrible homicide, he told a story that proves beyond a doubt that the arrest of Miss Lizzie Borden is backed up simply by theories and ideas of the police and executive officials of Fall River. The detective was seated in his easy chair in the parlor of his house, enjoying an after-dinner cigar when I entered. He very candidly explained his position. Quote, "I cannot tell you anything very startling about the murder, for no one as yet can give the motives or a true statement of how the crime was committed. I happened to be in town at the time the crime was committed and was consequently on the spot within a few moments. It was, without doubt, one of the most horrible crimes that has ever been enacted in this state, and so mystifying is everything connected with it that so far it has been impossible for the police to get certain proof against any one party. The police have not as yet secured any tangible evidence against the girl. Of course, their suspicions are firmly convinced that she was implicated in the atrocious murder, but until their suspicions are confirmed by more facts than they have collected at present, the daughter of Andrew J. Borden will not suffer the penalty for his death. It is true that the suspicions against Lizzie are many, and the case against her, considering the work put upon it, is very good. There is one thing that is certain, and that is a horrible double murder has been committed. The next question that interested the police was who could have committed the crime and what was the motive. Now it can be seen plainly by anyone who has followed the case that the only direct suspicions point to Lizzie. Whether or no she has or will profit by the death of her father and stepmother is a question that remains unsolved. There is at present nothing very positive against Lizzie Borden, and while every clue points to the fact that she, with her own hands or with the aid of someone, committed the foul deed, yet you take my word that unless developments are extraordinary between now and the day set for the preliminary hearing, the girl will not be held for the grand jury. It would not be doing her justice, and I doubt if any judge, even Judge Blaisdell, who has followed the case from the first, would hold the girl unless there were something in the shape of evidence besides theories and ideas. In commemoration of the 125th anniversary of America's greatest murder mystery, True Crime Historian brings you the Lizzie Edition. Part 4, The Great Borden Hearing. Basil pesto chicken with summer vegetable panzanella. Sautéed shrimp and green beans with globe tomatoes, spinach and orzo pasta. Meatball pizza with fresh mozzarella cheese and charm tomatoes. Not only does Blue Apron offer you delicious meals like this 3 times a week, but let me count the ways I love Blue Apron. 1. Affordable. $10 per person per meal delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients. 2. Variety. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week. 3. Flexible. Customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. 4. Easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card. 5. Guaranteed. Every ingredient in your delivery arrives fresh and ready to cook, or Blue Apron makes it right. So check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/truecrime. You'll eat like a gourmet and cook like a chef in your own kitchen with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/truecrime. Blue Apron.
a better way to cook.
Fall River, Massachusetts, August 15th, 1892. Bridget Sullivan, it is stated on good authority tonight, told the story which hastened the arrest of Lizzie Borden when questioned shortly after the murder by Officer Medley. She stated that the time elapsing between the moment she left the lower hall and saw that Mr. Borden was lying on the sofa and the moment when she answered Lizzie's startled cry for aid was little, if any, more than 10 minutes. She went to her room in the attic and sat down at the window. That window commanded a view of the yard and the approach and entrance to the barn. She sat there during a large part of these 10 minutes, but saw no one go to the barn or leave it. She had been troubled by nausea and decided to lie down on the bed. She was called from that position by Lizzie, who had just discovered her father's body. Lizzie, according to her own statement, went to the barn after placing her father at ease on the sofa. She is not sure how long she remained in the barn, but has given it this 20 or 25 minutes. That journey must have been made after Bridget passed through the hall and left father and daughter together in the sitting room. If Bridget was only 10 minutes in the attic before she heard Lizzie give the alarm, the latter could not have gone to the barn and remained there 20 minutes. It then comes down to a question of veracity or correct remembrance between Bridget and the prisoner. Of course, Bridget was questioned minutely at the inquest regarding her movements and the time spent in the attic. Whether or not she swore positively that she had not been more than 10 minutes in the attic before Lizzie summoned her is not known, but the statements given above come from a man who heard the servant answer Officer Medley's questions on the points alluded to. Much hinges on that journey to the barn. If it was made, Lizzie was out of the way when the old man was repeatedly hacked in the room adjoining the kitchen. If it was not made, the daughter could not have remained at the ironing fire without having heard the sounds of slaughter in the sitting room adjoining. There is no one to swear positively that Lizzie Borden did or did not go to the barn at the time in question. Charles Sawyer, who did picket duty at the house immediately after the crime, understood Bridget to say that she was 10 minutes or very little more than that in the attic. The questions which now arise are, can she fix the time beyond reasonable doubt? Can she tell during what portion of the time she spent in the attic she was looking out of the window, and was her stay before the window such that she might have seen Lizzie enter or leave the barn, if she had entered or left, in the interval between the moment Bridget went upstairs and the moment she was called down again? It was stated today that traces of fire and the ashes left by burned cloth had been found in the cellar. The story was laughed at headquarters, even though it purported to come from an officer who was on guard at the house. There might be reasons for believing that some ashes were found, but the buttons and hooks which might connect the find with clothing worn during the tragedy and destroyed immediately afterwards were purely imaginary. It would seem that any such significant traces must have been instantly detected when the police examined the cellar in the first instance. The hot ironing fire would surely have afforded less suspicious means of destruction. The ashes in the stove were carefully sifted by police shortly after the murder was discovered, but they found nothing. Chief Hilliard, in conversation today, dealt at some length with the criticisms to which he and his department have been subjected. He pointed out that he had acted under the advice of District Attorney Knowlton and that the public was almost entirely in ignorance of the evidence in hand. Unless the reasons for the arrest were known, he felt that judgment should be suspended. Taunton, Massachusetts, August 15th, 1892. State Detective George Seaver was in the city tonight and discussed the interesting phases of the state's theory with me at length. The murder is still a mystery, he began, that cannot be gainsaid. There is only circumstantial evidence of the most circumstantial sort yet in the state's possession. I do not believe there will be much to the inquest tomorrow, as we have not yet heard from Professor Wood as to the results of his analysis of the blood and the search for poison, and it will probably be adjourned over for a week unless he is heard from. I asked him, have you any evidence to the effect that Lizzie Borden changed her clothes on the day of the murder? He said, I can't say that we have. I asked, you could easily get an inventory of all the clothes she had, could you not? He retorted, how? I said, Emma would know. He said, but Emma is not going to testify to the injury of her sister. I said, in that Star Chamber inquiry, where no witness knew what the other was saying, Emma would have given a detailed statement without suspecting harm if she is the kind of girl they say she is. He said, possibly. I said, and Bridget would know, too. She would also know if she was arrested in the dress in which she had done the ironing. He said, yes, she might have worn a large apron that covered her dress, and Bridget has been asked that, but she is not sure. I asked, don't you think it would be a miracle for this girl to have done those frightful murders and received not a single clot of blood on her clothes? He answered, yes, I think it would be very remarkable, of course. But if she wore an apron that could easily be done away with, you know. I asked, there was blood sprinkled in every direction about the wounds, was there not? He answered, yes, in the case of the woman, small round drops of blood were found on the bed covers to the right and on the dresser to the left and in front, all within a radius of 4.5 feet. There were some marks on the carpet as though it had been trodden by somebody lifting the body. There was very little at the back, and that, I think, came from the hatchet as it was carried back for the repetition of blows. In the case of the man, there was considerable blood thrown back, I mean back of where the murderer stood. It is a remarkable feature of the tragedy how little blood there was scattered about. But beyond the immediate locality of the wound, only very small drops were scattered, and these were confined to a small radius. The reason given by the doctor, and which is reasonable, is that the first blow stopped the action of the heart, leaving no power to throw it. Besides, no large arteries were cut. I asked him, have you determined just in what attitude the murderer stood, as you speak of blood being thrown back of that point? He said, it is accepted that the blow that killed Mrs. Borden was from behind, and with the blunt end of the hatchet, and that the other cuts were inflicted after she had fallen. There's nothing absolute about that of Mr. Borden, but it is not reasonable to suppose that the murderer stood facing him as he lay. He probably stood at the end of the lounge and struck downwards. Reason and the character of the wounds indicate that. I asked, how do you account for the fall of Mrs. Borden's heavy body without attracting the attention of Bridget? The detective said positively, the talk about the fall shaking that house is nonsense. That is a strongly built old house, and I bet I could go up into that room and jump off the mantelpiece without being heard on the outside. Besides that, the body is not supposed to have fallen prone as it lay as a result of the blow such as she received. She would fall straight down first to her knees and then forward. There would be little noise about it. I said, in granting that, the person committing this deed would feel that any noise was a great noise calculated to attract attention. Considering that it was Lizzie Borden who knew the near vicinage of Bridge and how liable to discovery she was, would she have remained there to mutilate the body and afterwards be capable of returning quietly to her work? He said, Lizzie Borden knew that Bridget was outside and she had enough work to keep her there for an hour. She knew of her opportunity better than anybody else would know theirs. What would anybody else remain there for and hack the bodies? A man who wanted to murder would know that his first blow had done its work and would begin to look for safety. There were 19 cuts on the woman alone besides the first fatal one, and including one on the back discovered afterwards. I asked, but would not the same argument apply to Lizzie? He said, look at it any way you will. I grant you that this is a most singular case. I asked, how about the story that the mystery of the letter which was supposed to be received by Mrs. Borden is about to be explained? He said, I believe it is another of the many fakes that has been sprung in the case. I do not believe the letter was ever sent or received. I believe Lizzie Borden coined that story to account for the absence of the murdered woman in case any of the neighbors asked for her before the alarm was given, and that in the excitement afterwards she told it, although then she did not need to do so. If there had been a letter, a messenger boy, and a sick friend, they would have been heard from by this time. I asked, and they say the story of the poison has been explained also by women purchasing stuff to test the druggist. How about that? He said, that too is made up of whole cloth. Certain druggists were discovered some time ago to be selling a face lotion of some kind containing poison. The women were engaged to work it up. The druggist was convicted and fined, and it all occurred some time ago. I asked, now what do you think of the question of Judge Blaisdell sitting in both the inquest and the hearing? He said, it has been the custom for years. The inquest is not a judicial, but rather a medical inquiry. To be sure, the same evidence, or nearly all, is introduced in both cases. I asked, have you discovered any new evidence? He said, no, there would be some things developed at the inquest that it would not be proper to make public, but nothing has been turned up since, worth mentioning. And with this, the detective strolled on into the shadows of City Square. Emma Borden arrived this morning by the 8 o'clock train and remained through the day until the 3:30 train with her sister Lizzie at the jail. Their dinner, brought to them from the city hotel, was served in her cell. The Reverend W. Walker Jubb of the Central Church of Fall River, who preached yesterday in New Bedford, came over at 9 o'clock and went at once to the jail, where he was admitted and remained an hour with the sisters, returning to Fall River on the noon train. Mr. Jubb is pastor of the church of which Lizzie Borden is a member. The statement that the Reverend Mr. Buck was her pastor is an error, as Mr. Buck is a city missionary and no church to which there is a regular membership. Lizzie was, however, a teacher in the Mission Sunday School. A few moments after coming from the prison, Mr. Jubb said, quote, I was at Sarasota when I heard the news of the tragedy. I sent Lizzie a telegram and a letter at once, and my wife also wrote to her. I did not get back in time, however, to attend the funeral, and that, perhaps, accounts for the error in the matter of the pastor. Indeed, I do believe in Lizzie's innocence, absolutely, and I think her incarceration a tragedy of justice. I think that common decency would have caused Judge Blaisdell to step aside after having once given judgment so far as to order the issuing of a warrant. The Star Chamber proceeding by which they secured this evidence, which they claim to have, is a relic of barbarism. The thing cannot be put too strongly in condemnation. They say it was merely to secure her statement uninfluenced by lawyers' checks and restraints. Are we to understand that this girl was 4 hours making her statement? She was 4 hours on the stand at one time during the Star Chamber sitting, and that was not enough. She was called repeatedly afterward. How many questions do you suppose were asked her in that time, questions improper in kind and form? And every word was taken down, of course, and twisted, no doubt, to be used against her in the trial for her life. I tell you, it is an outrage. They have not enough evidence in to hold anyone for 24 hours, but because they can find no other explanation of the murder, they suspect her and say so, and then bend their energies to substantiate the statements. Think of the manner in which they got that drug clerk to positively identify Lizzie as the woman who bought prussic acid. Instead of bringing the two together where there were other women and asking him to point her out, they take him into her presence and ask him, is this the woman? And now it turns out that several women were being employed at that time to buy poison for the purpose of testing the druggist as to whether they were fulfilling the provisions of the law and selling it. That explanation will no doubt kill off the one most suspicious circumstance weighing against Lizzie. The other, about the letter which she says was delivered to her from Mrs. Borden in the morning, asking the latter to call upon a sick friend, can also, I learn, be explained. It is argued that the relations between Mrs. Borden and Lizzie were such that the former would not have told her the contents of the letter in any event. Now that is all nonsense. I had a long talk with Lizzie this morning. She told me that they were all on better terms during the past 2 years than they had ever been. She did not try to represent that there was any demonstration of affection between them, but she said that they were by no means unfriendly. The girls had always been independent, going and coming without asking anyone. Very often, however, and more especially of late, Mrs. Borden would say as she saw the girls dressing to go out, "Well, now, where are you off to, Lizzie?" or some such remark. To use Lizzie's own words, she said, "In all our lives there has never been a harsh word passed between Mrs. Borden and myself. There has simply been the consciousness that she was not my mother. I can freely say that she has been a good stepmother to me, as many stepmothers are. Only a few days ago at dinner, she said to me, 'Lizzie, I wish you would help me to fit a dress after dinner, will you?' And of course I did so, helping her to drape the dress to the best of my ability. That does not look as though we were very bitter toward each other, does it?" Unquote. Mr. Jubb, resuming his own thread of the talk, said, quote, "To my mind, it is impossibility for this girl to have committed that deed. From the moral side of it, we must first believe her insane to be capable of it without a greater motive than has been made apparent. There are no other evidences of insanity in her whole life before or since the murder, nor any in her family, as far as I can learn. Now, as to the evidence not touching on the marvelous cunning and nerve by which she must have exercised, and which has been discussed in the papers, I would like to call your attention to the entire absence of any sign about her of the deed. It has not been attempted to show that she changed her dress either before or after the murders. It has been shown that blood splashed from both victims in all directions and for some distance. How could it be possible that not a drop fell upon her dress? It would be very singular if she could commit one such murder and escape in that manner, but to do two, it is beyond reason. I went up into the room where Mrs. Borden was murdered and saw exactly where the body lay. They say she was probably looking out of the window at the time she was struck. If so, she must have been dragged several feet to where she was found. If that was done, there would be tracks of blood. There were none. Exactly where she lay, there was a pool and a few spots on the white covers of the bed a few feet to the right, but exactly opposite the head. She must have fallen where she was struck and was allowed to remain there." Unquote. Question: and does Lizzie say nothing concerning the injustice of the charge? Answer: no, or very little. She is willing to wait and be cleared by an investigation. Emma said to me this morning, "Mr. Jubb, Lizzie is as innocent of this crime as I am, who was not there. I cannot see the slightest motive she might have, either in the way of money or revenge, for of the first she had all she needed, and of the latter there was no reason." Now, Lizzie was very fond of her father. She asked, "Why don't they go to the bank and find out just how much ready cash she has to her credit? That would dispose of the question for money. They say that her father would not give her what money she wanted to take a vacation. What folly! She wanted to go to Marion for a few days. How much do you suppose she would need for that? And is it reasonable that with the pleasures of a holiday in her thoughts, she would turn to thinking of murder? I was talking to Mrs. Holmes about this question of the feeling between father and daughter the other day, and she corroborates the statements of the girls. She was very intimate with them, as everybody knows, and she said they were on excellent terms." Mr. Holmes, by the way, is the leading deacon in my church, of which Mr. Borden was also a member. He never attended, however, out of pique toward Mr. Holmes. Mr. Borden had a piece of property that the corporation decided to buy, but would not accede to Mr. Borden's price. Mr. Holmes voted against the paying price, as he thought it too high, and as a result, Mr. Borden never attended the church afterwards. Unquote. Mr. Jubb says that Lizzie is looking well and bearing up in a manner that surprises him. She does not read the papers and knows only what these friends see fit to tell her. Emma took her a copy of the Metropolitan, a paper which she thought gave a very fair statement of the case, but Mr. Jubb advised her against reading it, and she followed his advice. Lizzie is supplied with sewing and reading matter sufficient to occupy her fully when she is alone. Lizzie will not be taken to Fall River to attend the inquest tomorrow, but that proceeding will probably interfere with Emma's visit to her here, as the latter's presence will possibly be required. Fall River, Massachusetts, August 18th, 1892. For days, the wild-eyed man has skipped from place to place in this section with the face of nature, with seven-league boots and rubber-soled sneakers, with whiskers, without whiskers, with song and dance clothes and without the same, but invariably decorated with a goodly quantity of red blood corpuscles and invariably conspicuous by eyes of fire set deep above a countenance unfit for publication. Sam Fisk, the political mascot of the police force, and the other boys were spinning yarns about the wild-eyed man in the guardroom at headquarters. The shortening shadows foretold the coming of the noontide, and incidentally, the coming of the wild-eyed man. And all the while, the murderer was rapidly nearing the end of his journey over that 8 miles of dusty road from Westport. The unfortunate fairly yearned to be hanged. He fondled his bony neck and pushed on faster than ever. The stories of the gang were becoming quite lurid as the wild-eyed man turned the corner into Court Square, but they ceased the moment he hove in sight. Roscoe Conkling, someone said, as his gaunt form darkened the door of the station, but the wild eyes silenced the rising mirth in its infancy. He had come. Short, spare, with small eyes which burned bright in their sockets, where the shock of gray hair from above met on the flood tide of whiskers from below, with a shifty look, gaunt arms, tweed coat, one buttoned vest, checkered shirt, and trousers loud as the whisper of a field battery in action, he stood before them, the wild-eyed in all his glory, who would not be comforted by anything short of being hanged by the neck until he was very dead. He raised a bony finger and sought audience. "Is this police station house?" "Yes," in chorus. "Well, I'm the man that murdered the Bordens, and I've walked all the way from Westport to give myself up. I want to be hung right off." "All right," said Sam Fisk. "Get off your hat and coat and we'll fix you." Off came the hat and coat in a twinkling, and the wild-eyed man stood ready for business. Assistant Marshal Fleet was on the ground. "How did you come to do it?" he asked. With evident impatience at this postponement of full expiation, the wild-eyed made answer, quote, "I don't know how I came to do it. There wasn't any money in it for me, but I did it all right enough, and I want you to hang me right off. My conscience won't let me stand by and see Lizzie Borden suffer. I wish you'd hurry up," unquote. "Come inside," said the marshal, and at his bidding, the wild-eyed man followed with the alacrity of hope renewed. The marshal said when they had entered the chief's office, "Now tell us about it. Who are you?" "Me? I'm the man you're after. I'm Charles H. Peckham. The day I did it, I walked in from Westport. I'm a farmer down there, 2 miles from Central Village. After I got into town, I went up 3rd Street and then jumped over the Borden back fence." "Well, how'd you get into the house?" "I went in by the back cellar door. On my way upstairs, I found the hatchet. I went upstairs and killed Mrs. Borden, and then I waited around till the old man got home."
"And then?"
"And then I waited till Lizzie went out. I hacked the old man's head to pieces. I went down cellar again and threw the hatchet away as I went. I got out of the cellar door all right and jumped over the fence into 3rd Street and walked back to Westport. There, now, I've told you the thing and I want to be hung. You want a good strong rope, for I got a strong neck."
"Well, where are the clothes you wore?"
"I'm wearing them now, but they ain't bloody at all. The blood didn't fly around much because it had been stagnated by the poison they'd taken. There, now. And see, you don't believe me, but I know my business and I want to be hung."
"How'd you get over the fence when you went in, Mr. Peckham?"
"Jumped over it. Think I can't do it?"
And the man leaped the rail of the marshal's office just to show what he could do if necessary.
"Oh, I got over the fence all right, and I didn't tear my clothes either. I guess I wrapped the hatchet up in a piece of paper, but someone spirited it away.
I've been looking for it, but I can't find it nowhere. I went through Rodman Street and 8 Rod way over the bridge. I got a ride to where the South Road starts, and I walked home from there. I want to be hung. The assistant marshal said to an officer, I guess you better hang this man for safekeeping. Yes, and I want you to make a good job of it, too, the wild-eyed man interjected. You don't think I could do it, do you? Look at that arm. And he rolled up his sleeve and displayed a bony member. Oh, I got the courage to do it. Almost before the words were out of his mouth, a fire gong struck just at his ear. The 6-foot leap which the startled man made belied his words, and he recognized the fact instantly. Fearful that the exhibition would prejudice his chances of instant execution, he hastened to repair the break. Don't you think because that thing startled me a little, I couldn't do the job? I did it, and I tell you, I want to be hung. Have you got the gallows ready? The officer said, Oh, now, I say you can't expect us to get the scaffold ready in a minute. The wild-eyed replied, Well, I know, but I don't want to wait long. I thought this thing over a long time. The assistant marshal said, Come along and be hanged. And the unfortunate bounded after him with the joy born of the near approach of strangulation. He was locked up. His look was vacant and his manner wild. A little later, he called out from the cell where he'd been locked up and said, I want the knot right under my ear here. The assistant marshal searched the old man and found on his person an old pocketbook containing $5 in cash and some papers which identified him as Charles H. Peckham. His description is aged, about 62, hair partly gray, 5 feet 5 inches high, light pants and vest, dark coat and straw hat. He had a number of New Bedford newspaper clippings in his pocket containing accounts of the murder. It is thought probable that the reading of the great crime has turned his brain. Mr. Reed of Westport informed the police that he had known Peckham for years. The old man has shown signs of mental aberration from time to time, he says, and though honest and harmless, has never been able to get along on account of his eccentricities. Medical examiner Dolan went to the cell room to see him, and he insisted that the physician examine his neck to determine whether or not he would make a good subject for hanging. When assured that he would be all right, his face was radiant. All doubt had vanished. From without, he heard the noise of the hammers, where a gang of street workers were laying rails. In evident pleasure, he said, They're building the scaffold, ain't they? And then the doors closed upon him, and he sat down to wait patiently for the summons to the gallows, the black cap, and the noose. The unfortunate man was fed and given all possible attention by the police. Gradually, his hallucinations began to leave him. He grew calmer and toward night no longer spoke of the terrible crime of which he had accused himself but a few hours before. He seemed, in fact, to have forgotten it entirely and spoke in a wandering way about the haying at home and wondered why he was in custody. The terrible picture which had formed gradually in his excited imagination had been wiped away, and more natural impressions were replacing it. Mrs. Peckham, his wife, who was found on the farm near Central Village, was frantic with anxiety. She told the story of her husband's wanderings. She said that he had suffered from temporary insanity about 5 years ago. The attack was succeeded by a semi-comatose state, after which the mind would become clear again. She was anxious that he should be released at once and said she was quite able to care for him. She asserted positively that he had not been out of her sight for an hour since a day long before the murder, except when he visited Fall River a week ago today. He was an inoffensive man and would harm no one. A neighbor said Peckham was about the farm on the morning of the murder. Mrs. Peckham sent a neighbor to Fall River to bring her husband home. The police had no wish to detain him when once sure that there was no danger that he could do violence to himself or others. The man had simply been reading and thinking incessantly about the murder, and his mind gave way temporarily beneath the strain. Suddenly, the conviction that he himself was guilty fastened upon him. The newspapers and his abnormal imagination supplied the necessary details. Instantly, he set off for Fall River. The heat was intense, and that with the usual exertion of fast walking increased his mania. Hence his hurried confession and intense desire to be hanged at once and have done with it. His neighbor Reed said, quote, "He has not been strong for years, and he would not harm a mouse," unquote. The police, from the moment the man entered the station, humored him and attempted to calm his mind. Never for a moment did they regard his statements seriously. Everyone was sorry for him, though the advent of a self-accused murderer has long been regarded as probable. At 8:45 tonight, Mrs. Peckham and Constable Grinnell drove up to headquarters and said they had come for Peckham. Captain Desmond went to the man's cell to see if he was in a fit condition to be set at large. The self-accused man was sleeping soundly. He was awakened, and after a glance at the suggestive surroundings, he said, "What am I doing here?" He was told that he had confessed to the murder of the Bordens. "It's not so," he said. "I never did it." After a few further questions, he was taken to the guardroom. "Do you know this man, Peckham?" Captain Desmond asked, pointing to Grinnell. The man scratched his head pensively for a moment and then said heartily, "Hello, Grinnell." That was all. Mrs. Peckham bundled him into the old country carriage. The constable whipped up the horse. The trio were lost in the night, and Charles Peckham's career as a murderer was at an end. It was, in truth, an odd book, and its name was Imaginary Murder. August 19th, 1892. I had quite a long talk with Bridget Sullivan this morning. Bridget is a typical Irish girl, large of frame, plump and round of figure, with a fine color in her cheeks and dancing animation in her eyes. She is built all through to the plan of her height, which is above the average for a woman. But her cheerful spirit, her energy and animation, are clouded by the tragedy that has interrupted the even flow of her life. She is gloomy, and to the approaches of a stranger who seeks to have her tell what she saw and did on the day of the murders, she wears an air of defiance, and the mirth, which one can easily see even at such times as natural to her eyes, takes flight. Bridget lives with her married sister in a tenement in the south end of the town, at the corner of Division and Almond Streets. I drove over there this morning, and, as I say, talked a good deal to Bridget. For her part, she is not making a display of her conversational powers. The family of three live in a little flat on the third floor, and in answer to my knock at the door in the hall, the sister, also a sturdy woman, both in general build and her voice, but without any of the bright animation of Bridget, opened it. In answer to the query, she said simply, "Yes, she is here," and swung the door a little further open and looked toward an inner room. I stepped in, and the well-known figure of Bridget stood framed in a doorway leading to a room beyond. The man of the house sat in one corner, evidently having just come back from his work to his dinner, for the tablecloth was already spread and the meal was steaming on the stove, all of which was unfortunate. They were disposed to be civil, all of them, but with the mention of the tragedy, Bridget began to bridle. She said, quote, "Now I have said before the court all I know about it. I have told the truth. I wouldn't lie for anybody, and I ain't going to say anything more about it." Question: do you know what you were reported in the newspapers as having said? Answer: I don't care what they say in the newspapers. Question: did you see that Dr. Handy intimates that you, in your testimony, you may be trying to shield yourself? Answer: I don't care what Dr. Handy says. If he will mind his own business, I will mind mine. Question: but you see, he doesn't. The suggestion is that you did this thing yourself or had something to do with it. With scarcely increased color or emphasis, she said, "Well, I didn't. My conscience is clear. I went down there and told what I know and what I saw, and that's all I have to do with it." I said, and they've been printing stories about your having seen a hatchet in the kitchen or sitting room on the day of the murder. She said, well, they've been printing plenty of things, but I can't help it. I told them all I knew and I saw, and I wouldn't tell a lie, and I ain't going to tell it again. I asked, did the district attorney tell you not to say anything? Answer, no, he didn't. Question, well, you can't have any objection to saying whether it's true that you were sick on that day and that you laid down because of that. Answer, well, no, I wasn't just sick, she said in that slow way which is meant to qualify a term. And as she said this, she went back into her own little bedroom, for during this talk, which was not as straight as is here told, but took little excursions one way and another of no general interest, she had gone over and sat down by the table and at a window, the outer shutters of which were drawn. In the other room, she was easily within conversing distance, but took advantage of her being there to make no answer at all when I asked her whether, not having been sick herself, she took any stock in the poisoning story. I asked, how long have you been in the Borden's employ? She replied, 3 years. I asked, and you were on good terms with them? She replied, yes, sir, I liked them all. They always treated me very well. I asked, the girls, did they like you? Answer, yes, at least I liked them. They always treated me well. Question, and you have nothing to say against them now? Answer, no, of course not. Question, what have you to say about having been compelled to walk to the police court through the crowd? Answer, well, I was able to walk, I guess. I didn't have to ride. Question, have you any idea of employing counsel to look out for you at the trial in case any attempt is made to implicate you? Answer, what do I need of counsel? I'll tell you, my conscience is clear. They can do what they please. All I have to do is tell what I saw. No, sir, I will have no lawyers. Unquote. The dinner was being placed on the table. The man of the house was anxious to dispose of it and return to his work. And so I came away. Lizzie Borden's closest friend in Fall River is Mrs. Mary Brigham, who lives on Lincoln Avenue, a handsome residence in the North End, the fashionable end of town. Mary Brigham has been the companion of Lizzie Borden through every period of her life. They went to the old Canal Street Primary School together and were playmates as children, companions as young girls, and close friends as grown women. Mrs. Brigham arrived at the Borden house as soon after hearing of the tragedy as she could. She was there much of the time during the period that the house was under guard. She was Lizzie's companion and support during all those trips to the police courts, was with her at the time she was arrested, and only left her then because the hand of the law laid upon her friend and would not permit her to return to the world. Next to Lizzie Borden speaking for herself, therefore, Mrs. Brigham can best of all others now living speak for her. Thus far, she has remained silent. She has spoken to no one for publication, but today, moved, as she said, by a desire to set her friend right as against the calumnies that have been uttered against her, she granted me an interview, which extended through 2 hours. She began, quote, I will tell you all that I know concerning the incidents of Lizzie's recent life that bears upon this frightful tragedy. But first, I wish you would stamp as a lie the allegation that Lizzie was not happy with her father and mother, her stepmother, I mean. She has told me many times that these latter years of her life have been her happiest. The story that she would not sit at the table with her father is a falsehood of the blackest sort. It has long been understood and accepted in the house that she could take her breakfast when she wished, and the family did not wait for her if she was not up. She would come down when she was ready, and either prepare her own breakfast or Bridget would make her some toast. I know of many other women who do the same, and it was never thought remarkable until this happened. It has been said that Mr. Borden was angry and did not speak to Lizzie upon her return from Europe. That, too, is simply a falsehood, distorted out of facts that were as contrary to the statement as could be. On the night Lizzie arrived, the family had given her up, and Mr. and Mrs. Borden had gone to bed. Lizzie was very tired and only spoke a few words to Emma that night and retired. The next morning, Mr. Borden found her steamer chair in the hall and bounded up the stairs three at a time to see and greet her, and Lizzie told me that her hand ached all day, he pressed it so hard. Going downtown, he met a man who said to him, "Well, I would guess that someone had come home, judging from your bright face this morning." Mr. Borden was, as they say, not a demonstrative man, but he loved his daughters and showed it at such times when they came back after being away. He did not like them to be away from home. I could give you very many illustrations of this, showing Lizzie's kind consideration for her father and he for her. For instance, both the girls would have much preferred to live in this part of town to where they did, and often expressed the wish, of course, but said that it was better for their father, more convenient, to live where they did, as it was near his business interests, and so they did not urge it. On the other hand, the father, knowing the wish, told them only a short time ago to look for a house in this neighborhood. Now, as to Mrs. Borden, while she was a very good woman, she was not at all affectionate or calculated to draw the children to her. She was simply mild and good, and so long as things went smoothly, she would have very little to say about the house. So that this should not be taken as proof of any bitterness of feelings between them, for there was none. Lizzie Borden was a kind and generous girl, very generous, who would do anything in the world for anyone she thought much of. Whenever there were subscriptions to be made up, she contributed liberally, and I have seen her assume debts at the church all herself. These stories of her being skimped for money are equally false with the others. While her income was scarcely in keeping with the wealth of her father, she had more money than she needed. She had the best of clothes, her room was fitted luxuriously as a parlor and bedroom, and she bought books by the set rather than by the volume. Now let me tell you about the arrangements for her outing at Marion just previous to the tragedy. I was invited to be part of that party, and like her, I could not go with those who went first, although the fact that she couldn't has been spoken of so singular. She couldn't go because her father and mother were going to Swansea. Her mother was depending upon a certain woman to go with her as companion, as Mr. Borden spent so much time in town that she would not remain over there alone. They found she couldn't get the woman, so she gave up the idea, and Mrs. Borden told Lizzie to go on with her plans. Previous to this, Lizzie had promised to act as substitute for the secretary of the Christian Endeavor Society at their meeting on Sunday. It was an important consecration and business meeting. Had it not been for this, she would have gone to Marion on Saturday, but she would not break her word. It was early in the week when her mother told her she might go on with her plans, and she was determined to visit her mother's cousin, Mrs. Morris, at Warren for a couple of days, and wrote her to that effect. She was taken violently ill on Tuesday morning, and Wednesday morning, not feeling well enough, she wrote to Mrs. Morse that she could not come. Now, no one can ever convince me that a woman who had thus given up her own plans for a week to keep her word with the Christian Endeavor Society, and who had forgone her pleasure to serve her father and mother, could be plotting murder in her heart. And, as to insanity, there has never been a trace of it about her. She was a girl of very even temper. She never became excited. She had ideas, spoke them quietly and clearly. She could not be insane for the instant of committing the murder and then return to her normal self instantly, and after each of the two murders, for I think Mrs. Borden was murdered first, as do the others. Her conduct since the murder has been just what anyone who knew her would expect. They speak of her dry eyes. Is it not all too awful to cry about? We might weep, as all of us have, for the death of Mr. and Mrs. Borden, but this is too terrible. Even I cannot weep in the face of it. Her pride was touched at the first sign of suspicion being directed against her, and the horror of it has kept her as she is. To the whole world, it is a mystery how these murders could have been committed and the perpetrators escape without leaving the slightest clue behind. To Lizzie Borden, leaving her father asleep on the lounge and after a few minutes' absence, returning to find him butchered, it must even be a more astounding mystery. Has she expressed no idea as to how or by whom it was committed? Answer. I know what she thinks, but she has, of course, been closely questioned about that at the inquest, and I would not care to say anything about it before the hearing. Question. Does she suspect anyone? Answer. No, I can say that she suspects no one. Question. Can you tell me how the murders might have been committed? I do not wish to add to the many theories which have been discussed, but I know that Lizzie herself has often spoke to her mother about the arrangement of the rooms and halls of the house, and how anyone might come in and go all over the house without anyone knowing it. Members of the family have often done so and spoken of it. The house is a very solid old building, and any noise or jar is not easily heard. A man could have entered by the cellarway or the side door, gone up the stairs and killed Mrs. Borden, and afterwards gone down and hidden in the parlor, which was rarely entered by any of the family. From there, he could see anyone in the sitting room, and taking opportunity, have killed Mr. Borden and passed out, either by the cellarway, or, which would have been easier, turned the spring latch and walked out the front door and down the street, as would a caller at the house. Question. Knowing the family and its history as you do, have you no theory as to who committed the murder? Answer. No, I have not. Mr. Borden was a man who spoke his mind very freely to anyone, and if they attempted to reply, he would shut his teeth and walk away. Of course, he had enemies, but none that I could suspect of such a deed. Question. Have you any idea of the character of the testimony given by Bridget Sullivan, which they say was chiefly the cause of determining the arrest of Lizzie? Answer. I have not. Bridget, they called her Maggie, has been with the Bordens for 4 years, a faithful servant of whom they thought very much. They believed that if she said anything, reflecting upon Lizzie, that she was confused during the examination. Emma visited me since Lizzie's arrest. Neither of them have said one word against her. Emma said, "Poor Maggie, no wonder she wants to get away from the house." No matter what comes of this, I will never say one word against Maggie. She has been a good girl. She was frightened. That is what is the matter. I'm sure Lizzie was, and it would not be strange if she said conflicting things. Why, she was dazed and half fainting at the time she discovered her father's body, and says she could not tell a straight story of what took place. From that time on, her mind was in the same condition. Dazed, that's the word. She was wrought up to the highest tension, in a constant state of ignorance of what was coming next. Whatever she may have said in that condition, would it be strange if it conflicted at times? And would it be any more so if Maggie's did? No, it is all a horrible mystery, but Lizzie Borden will soon be proven guiltless. Unquote. Fall River, Massachusetts, August 25th, 1892. The battle for Lizzie Borden's life is on. It promises to be long and bitter, even in its preliminary stages. Fall River has known no such crush for seats as they witnessed this morning in the district courtroom. 5/6 of the audience was made up of women. The tragedy billed for 10 o'clock was too rare to miss. Soon Judge Blaisdell had disposed of an indignant female charged with disturbing the peace, and after a few minutes' intermission, the case was on. Today, though much of the time was occupied in the routine of establishing the fact of murder, the hearing was of tragic interest throughout. Fall River, New England, one might say, has witnessed no such scene as that of today, when Andrew Borden's daughter heard without the movement of a muscle a recital so ghastly in its details that it elicited frequent exclamations of horror from the curious who had come to see and hear. While the medical examiner was describing the most ghastly sight he had met in his long experience as a surgeon, the woman at whose door this fiendish mutilation is laid looked at him in the eye without a shudder. 100 leaned forward to mark the effect of the awful wounds. If they expected a betrayal of emotion, They were disappointed. Lizzie Borden's color did not change. Once she lowered her head and shut her eyes. It was only for a moment. The next, she gazed steadily at the witness again. She, who had given no sign during her imprisonment in the Chamber of Horrors on 2nd Street, had steeled her heart against the horror of today. Once or twice, she laughed. It was a nervous laugh, wrung from her by the meshes in which Colonel Adams entangled the medical examiner. Dr. Dolan said that where Mrs. Borden lay, there was a clear foot between her body and the bed on one side, and the same distance between the body and the wall on the other. The counsel led him along to the statement that Mrs. Borden was an unusually large woman, and then recalled the civil engineer's statement that the space in which she lay was only 2 feet 10 inches in width. Subtracting the 2 feet mentioned by Dr. Dolan, Colonel Adams pointed out that there was just 10 inches left in which the deceased could have lain. There was a general laugh. The prisoner joined it momentarily, though with the horror of the previous testimony still upon them, her sister and Mrs. Holmes, who sat beside her, did not smile. The prisoner's demeanor was the feature of the day. Many said it was the firmness of conscious innocence. Many more said it was the demon coolness which had enabled her to do so well the work which she now heard described. Upon that point, the evidence will in time throw light. So far, that light is lacking. Almost all of today's session was occupied by the testimony of medical examiner Dolan. It touched the accused only at intervals. Dr. Dolan swears that the cause of death was shock from the wounds. The Bordens, then, were not mutilated after having died from poison. Again, the nature of the stains on the hatchet and axe and on Lizzie's clothing was not determined by the doctor's testimony. He believes the blows were given by a hatchet found in the cellar. It was stained, and upon it 2 short hairs, one gray and one dark brown, were found. Such blows could easily have been delivered by a person of moderate strength. That was the substance of today's testimony. The motive, the prisoner's movements on the day of the tragedy, the letter to Mrs. Borden, the statements of the accused when questioned just after the tragedy, and most of all, the testimony of Bridget Sullivan are yet to come. Tomorrow, Dr. Dolan is to produce the ghastly pictures which photographer Walsh made of the interior of the house and the skulls of the deceased. The counsel for Lizzie Borden have permitted the publication of the following letter received by Miss Emma Borden on the day after it was dated. Waltham, Massachusetts, August 17, 1892. Miss Emma Borden. Dear Madame, you must excuse that I take the liberty in sending you these few lines. I ought to have written to you before this, but I was unable to do so as I was traveling every day. My name is Samuel Robinski. I am a Jewish peddler. When the fatal murder in Fall River occurred, I was only a few miles from Fall River that day. While sitting on the roadside toward New Bedford, I met a man who was covered with blood. He told me that he worked on a farm and that he never could get his wages, so he had a fight with the farmer. He said he ran away and did not get any money after all. All he had was a $5 bill. He bought from me 4 handkerchiefs, 1 looking glass, 1 necktie, collar, and shoe blacking. His boots were covered with blood, and he put lots of blacking on them. I helped him to fix up again and get cleaned, but by this time I did not know anything about the murder. I felt sorry for him and thought only he gave the farmer a good licking. I advised him to travel at night, which he said he would do, as he feared arrest during the day. I gave him my lunch, and he gave me a quarter and told me not to say anything that I had met him. He asked me what time the train left for Boston after 8 o'clock at night, and I told him. He also had a bundle with him, which was about 2 feet thick. When I was peddling, I did not read any papers, only Sunday, as I am studying the English language. When I was in Boston last Sunday, a friend of mine told about the Fall River murder. I told him that I was in Fall River and around the neighborhood. I told him about my stranger, and my friend said, "But why did you not report this to the police?" I told him I was afraid, as they would lock me up as a witness, and another thing, I did not have any license, so I was afraid. I told my friend I would write to you or Mr. Jennings. I read last Sunday's Boston paper and thought I might have seen the murderer. If I should see him here in Boston, I am sure, yes, dead sure, I should know him again. He is of medium height, dark brown hair, reddish whiskers or mustache, weight about 135 pounds, gray suit, brown derby hat. His shoes were what they call Russian leather, no blacking, or so-called summer shoes. He put my blacking on so he could make them look black and people could not see the blood. It was about 4 o'clock on that day. I only heard about the murder at 6 or 7 o'clock that night. I kept quiet, as I had no license and feared to be arrested. My stranger was very much afraid. He asked me a million times if he looked all right again, and I brushed him off with my shoe brush and told him to wait till dark. If I come again to Fall River, I shall call on you if you think it necessary, but all I can swear is to the stranger which I have seen that afternoon. This is all. But if this man was the murderer, I cannot say, but I shall find him out of 100,000. We'll close now. We'll return to Fitchburg tomorrow morning and return to Boston Saturday night. Please do not say anything to the police, as I have no license and would be arrested. If I had known about the murder about the time I met my stranger, it would have been different, as I would have followed him up and perhaps got the reward. I thought it was a poor farmhand and so took pity on him, as I know as a rule, farmers seldom pay their hands during the summer. Hoping that my information will be of some use to you, I remain very respectfully, Samuel Robinski. P.S. Please excuse paper and mistakes. I am a foreigner. August 26th, 1892. Guilty or not guilty? The second day of the hearing in the great Borden tragedy is over. Sensational as it was, important as were the witnesses sworn, the question, which coupled with Lizzie Borden's name, has rung throughout the length and breadth of the continent, is still unanswered. There is accusation, but not yet proof. Today, Bridget Sullivan, confessedly the most important witness for the state, began her evidence. So far as she has gone, and the district attorney has already carried her over the ground lying between the night preceding the murder and the moment she discovered the full extent of the crime, she has said little that is damaging, unless it be used as confirmatory testimony, and nothing which directly connects the prisoner with the actual commission of the crime. Tomorrow, evidence of the most damning character may be drawn from her, that is, for tomorrow. Her testimony, that of John V. Morse, the decapitation story by Dr. Dolan, the failure of the first apparent step to establish a motive, testimony which detailed the events of that fatal morning as noted by one of two occupants of the Borden house who survived the tragedy, this, in all, made the session of today one of interest most absorbing. No one except the district attorney would have cared to predict that Bridget would be called today. When she was called, she faced a courtroom thronged and feverish in its excitement. Two women were in or within call of the house during all the time considered of importance on August 4th. One, the daughter, is accused of the double murder. The other, the servant, is the witness whose testimony at the inquest, it was generally conceded, caused the arrest. Little wonder, then, that every ear was strained to catch the honest Irish girl's words, since they were believed to be weaving or destroying the web of the law. Bridget was somewhat disconcerted by the crowd and the responsibility of her position, but though she spoke in a low tone, the absolute silence of the courtroom made every syllable distinct. The girl never hesitated. If her testimony had been rehearsed, she could scarcely have answered more readily. By two witnesses, C.C. Cook, and John V. Morse, the state attempted to establish the statement that Andrew Borden had decided to make a will and had announced that decision. The testimony of both witnesses on this point was plain and prompt in denial of any knowledge or conversation concerning the old man's will, except that he had none. There was another point. John V. Morse states under oath that he thinks the cellar door was open when he passed around the house just after the murder had been committed and before he knew of it. Again, when Bridget went to the door on the morning of the murder to admit Mr. Borden at a moment when Mrs. Borden is supposed to have lain dead in the guest chamber, the girl attempted to open the door suddenly. Finding it locked, she uttered an exclamation which her modesty would not permit her to repeat on the stand today. There was a laugh from the hall and the floor above. Lizzie, Bridget says, was laughing at her exclamation. And yet, at that moment, if the police are right, Lizzie should have been engaged in concealing all evidences which might connect her with the crime the guest chamber must sooner or later disclose. Mrs. Borden, not Lizzie, told Bridget to wash the windows, and therefore it was Mrs. Borden, and not Lizzie, whose command led to Bridget's absence from the house, an absence which has been called suspiciously convenient. On the other hand, Lizzie, Bridget swears, did say Mrs. Borden had gone out in response to a note sent by a sick friend. One of the most exciting scenes of the day grew out of a general discussion of the alleged confession story, which has been so often denied, and the denial of which will be a feature of the trial story throughout New England today. That moment came when the witness, Dr. Dolan, said, quote, "The bodies have been interred. The skulls were removed by the bodies by instructions of the Attorney General. The skulls were cleaned and the bodies are now buried without the heads. The skulls were photographed and they are now in my possession." Unquote. No member of the Borden family was informed of the removal and photographing of the skulls, so far as the witness knew. For some time after the hearing opened this morning, it gave no promise of the climax of interest reached in the afternoon. The spectators were listless, and though there was much anxiety about securing seats, there was no such determined fight for place as that of yesterday. Women, though present in large numbers, were not nearly so numerous as at the opening. Some people have a penchant for first nights, you know. Mrs. Holmes and Mrs. Brigham, weary and sad, arrived just before 10 o'clock and were seated on the prisoner's bench. The prisoner and her sister entered a moment later, the Reverend Mr. Buck following. Lizzie Borden was carefully gloved and gowned as usual. Her appearance gave no evidence that her composure was at all shaken. She bowed and smiled upon Colonel Adams, chatted a moment with her sister and Mrs. Holmes, and then perused with interest a letter which was handed to her. The curiosity which prompted a general shifting of positions among the audience apparently caused her no annoyance. Lizzie Borden seems to have passed the point where the gaping of the crowd annoys. She placed a smelling bottle to her nose for a moment and then settled down to listen to the cross-examination of Dr. Dolan. She placed her left elbow in her right hand, supporting her chin with her left palm. That was at the opening. She was somewhat shaken by the sensation which came later and during the rest of the session was markedly self-conscious. At times, she bit her lip nervously and her face told of the struggle for composure. During Dr. Dolan's recital of the removal and cleaning of the skulls and the burial of the headless trunks, Emma Borden covered her face and wept. A hush fell upon the room. Women turned away. Mercilessly, Colonel Adams pressed his ghastly questions home, awaiting with indignant pause Dr. Dolan's admission of the decapitation. Testimony evidently was creating a bad impression. At last, the witness announced that he had acted under instructions of the Attorney General. Through it all, Lizzie Borden's efforts to be calm were very noticeable. During the first few of these gruesome questions, she looked steadily straight before her, compressing her lips, but still refraining from the emotion betrayed by her sister. As the recital proceeded, she placed her hand over her eyes as if to repress the tears that she felt must come. For a moment, it seemed she would give way utterly. The next, the climax was past. The questions of Colonel Adams became lighter, and she resumed her old position and expression. By the time Bridget Sullivan was put on, the prisoner was little disturbed, and though Bridget was examined with special reference to Lizzie's movements, the latter displayed little more than a somewhat nervous interest. With the crowd, it was different. They had expected testimony, which did not come. August 30th, 1892. Day after day, as the state has revealed what it has had of evidence against Lizzie Borden, the story has been told in its completeness in these dispatches, together with the summary and advice that perhaps tomorrow it would show cause, as the lawyers say, for holding her. The story is completed today, and whether or not they have done so may well be left for the public to judge. The state has closed its case amid a series of sensations. Professor Wood has submitted the result of his inquiries, and that formed the first sensation. He was expected to introduce a whole lot of blood corpuscles on the scene. He did not do it. He testified that he found no blood on the hatchet, no human hair on the hatchet, no blood on the waist or skirt of the outer dress, no blood on the shoes or stockings, no prussic acid or other poison, and no evidence of any other in either of the stomachs. The testimony, delivered with the matter-of-fact deliberation of a man of science, was received by the prosecution and the audience with undisguised surprise. There was a small spot of blood the size of a pinhead on the white underskirt, the skirt next to the dress, down near the hem. The professor stated that science could not demonstrate beyond a doubt that it was human blood. There was hair found upon the hatchet, it was true, but it was that of a cow or some other animal. There had been another hair, but it had been lost. This means nothing less than that the weapon has not been found. The house and surroundings have been thoroughly ransacked, even to the digging up of wells and cutting into chimneys, walls, and partitions. Is it fair to presume that it is not on the premises? How did it get away? Who took it away? The value of the theory as attached to the wild-eyed man must take an upward tendency. The court took its recess at noon with the indulgence of this testimony, sitting smilingly upon the friends of Lizzie Borden. The afternoon was consumed in the reading by Mr. Knowlton of the court stenographer's report of her testimony as taken at the inquest. The effect of this was not the same in every instance. It closed the case of the prosecution, and court adjourned at 5 o'clock, leaving those who had heard it to take issue with each other on the street corners, in the lobby of the hotels, and over family supper tables as to how it should be judged. Whatever else it may have shown, it was the record of a pitilessly sustained and searching examination, such as no defendant charged with crime and having the protection of court and counsel would be subjected to. The stenographer's story, in its faithfulness to detail, presents a picture of bickerings and bandying of words between the witness and prosecuting attorney that with all fair minds should be kept in view when considering the frequent contradictions as to details which the testimony presents. The record was of 3 sittings at which Miss Borden was required to answer, telling over and over again her every act of that day of the murder. The first sitting consumed 3 straight hours. The reading of the whole today, in such rapid fashion that only expert stenographers could follow, consumed nearly 2 hours. In anticipation, perhaps, of the prisoner being placed on the stand, the courtroom was more crowded this afternoon than at any other time since the trial began. Not only did the testimony offered create sustained sensation, but Mr. Jennings, during the morning session, put an edge on the proceedings by a little satire of his own. While Professor Wood was on the stand, the judge's bench was filled up with pieces of doorframe and other lumber containing spots of blood. There was a question of having it analyzed. Mr. Jennings rescued a piece of plaster from the ceiling, spotted red, and it was wrapped in a cloth. Mr. Jennings demanded assurance from the court that the piece should be preserved as it was and not be trifled with. He was willing to concede, he said, that this was human blood. It did not have to be analyzed and must not be. Mr. Knowlton looked surprised. Said Mr. Jennings, quote, "We wish to place this in the custody of the court and to have the assurance that it will be kept there. Otherwise, I shall put it in my pocket," unquote. Mr. Knowlton arose and remarked that this was the most remarkable proceeding that he had ever witnessed during his professional career, that the counsel in a case should undertake an open court to appropriate by main force the evidence secured by the state and keep it for its own use. He said, quote, "I want this thing returned to custody of the court." Jennings said, "That is exactly what we want to do with it, but we want the assurance that it will be held there." Judge Blaisdell said, "The court can give no such assurance." Jennings said, "Then we keep it," wrapping the valuable bit of plaster in a cloth and sitting down. The matter was allowed to pass with Mr. Jennings still holding his treasure, while another witness was called, his attention drawn away. Mr. Jennings and Adams held a short consultation and a moment later signified to the court that their willingness to return the plaster to the court's keeping with the privilege to file a motion on its behalf. So the matter passed. The value to the defense of the plaster from the ceiling bearing a blood spot will be seen in that it shows how far the blood was thrown and how liable the murderer was to have been marked by it. During the entire day, with the case of the state being knocked to pieces by Professor Wood in the morning and the rehearsal of her own shifting allegations and contradictory statements in the afternoon, the prisoner was much the same woman so often described. There was, perhaps, a gleam of satisfaction in her eyes in the first instance and simply a watchful attention in the second. Whether she will be called to the stand tomorrow, her counsel will not state. They expressed satisfaction at having secured the record of the inquest, declaring that is that they hope for most. The character of the client's testimony as read, they say, gives them no anxiety. September 1st, 1892. Lizzie A. Borden. The prisoner at the bar arose. Strong men struggled to control the emotion which almost overwhelmed them. Women bent low their heads and wept silently. The judge himself sat limp and helpless after the decision which he had found it almost impossible to announce. The strangest of women, the chief figure in that strangest of scenes, stood erect and firm though the die was cast. Steady, though the end had come, in a word, herself. The judgment of this court is that you are probably guilty of the charge against you. It is therefore the order of this court that you be committed to the county jail at Taunton to await the action of the grand jury. That was all. She sank down beside the aged minister and calmly waited to be escorted back to her room. The closing scene of the long hearing was deeply tragic. It finds few parallels in the history of criminal procedure. Once during it all, when her counsel spoke with emotion that choked him of the old man whose youngest child she was, the prisoner covered her face for a moment and wiped away the scalding tears which had come at last. Throughout the impassioned appeal of Mr. Jennings, she was visibly affected. But the keen, clear, uncompromising logic of the district attorney did not move her. Even during his dramatic presentation of the circumstances which, he submitted, gave her the exclusive opportunity for the commission of the crime, even when he said conclusively, quote, "It was at that moment that the hatchet entered the skull of Abby Borden," unquote, the prisoner showed no emotion. Before Judge Blaisdell had finished his first sentence, she knew her fate and knew why it had come. Out of her own mouth, she was condemned. She had expected it and remained unshaken. Mr. Jennings threw his soul into his appeal for the prisoner. He first proceeded to calmly dissect the evidence which the state presented, claiming that it was entirely circumstantial, that it did not show that an outside assassin would necessarily have been seen had he approached or left the house, that it did not disprove the statement of the prisoner in reference to her movements on the morning of the crime, that her contradictory statements should not weigh against her because of the extraordinary examination to which she had been subjected at the secret inquest, that the testimony proved no motive whatever, that the prisoner had no motive, and finally, that the crime laid at her door was, all things considered, beyond the bounds of credibility. On the other hand, he dwelt at length upon the effect of Professor Wood's testimony and that of Dr. Draper, saying it was fatal to the cause of the prosecution, and pointed out that beyond question, suspicious men had been seen on the premises of the morning of August 4th. He scored medical examiner Dolan and Eli Bentz because of the unwarranted strength of their testimony, and concluded with a peroration marked by fine fire and dramatic force, in which he demanded the release of the prisoner. It was a fine effort. At its close, the crowd involuntarily broke into enthusiastic applause. The prisoner was visibly affected. Colonel Melvin O. Adams, who sat beside her, was unable to restrain his emotion. His heart was in the grand fight that his colleague was making. He drew a handkerchief across his eyes repeatedly and warmly clasped Mr. Jennings' hand in congratulation when the latter had finished. The Reverend Mr. Buck followed the counsel's words as though they were inspired. Every one of them found an echo in his heart. His face told that. The audience heard in breathless silence. They sympathized with the spirit of that grand appeal, but they feared it was unavailing. The district attorney, calm and matter-of-fact as usual, asked that the court adjourn until after dinner, as he did not wish to break the continuity of his argument. Crowds thronged the entrances long before 2 o'clock, fighting for an opportunity to witness a scene which they felt would be unparalleled in the history of Fall River. Attorney General Pillsbury sat beside Mr. Knowlton when the court reassembled. The district attorney's address was, it is generally conceded, a magnificent presentation of the case of the Commonwealth. Every sentence was cutting. His diction was smooth and his manner unimpassioned until he was well into his argument. Taking up the evidence, he proceeded by a process of exclusion to show that the prisoner alone had an opportunity to commit the crime. With that given, he dissected her alibi, claiming that it was flimsy and did not weigh for a moment against the testimony of Bridget, the indications that the work was that of a woman, and the fact that it was Mrs. Borden who was the first object of attack and the chief object of hatred. Lizzie alone had that opportunity, and she had made an attempt to purchase prussic acid. Her actions were consistent with guilt. He dwelt strongly upon the inhumanity of the crime and the lamentable but inevitable necessity for charging the daughter with it, and closed with an incisive demand that duty and justice be met as the circumstances warranted. Judge Blaisdell's decision was evident before he had spoken a dozen words. He spoke with extreme difficulty throughout and was forced to pause for some time before completing his announcement. The crowd was subdued and the pause extremely affecting. For a moment, it seemed that the judge would break down. Tears filled his eyes. His voice was tremulous and husky. Then he rallied and said slowly with extreme sadness,
"Probably guilty."
The clerk announced the pleasure of the court, and it was over. Taunton, Massachusetts, September 2nd, 1892. Lizzie Borden returned to her cell in the jail at Taunton today. She was received by Sheriff Wright and the matron, his wife, and went through the formula prescribed for the reception of prisoners in a matter-of-fact manner. There was no emotional scene as upon her first entry there. The cell which she previously occupied was assigned to her again, and thus her imprisonment of 2 months preceding the sitting and action of the grand jury begins. It was expected that she would be brought to the city on the train leaving Fall River at 11:03 a.m., and a large crowd gathered in the station in anticipation of getting a glimpse of her. The train came and went, however, and the prisoner did not appear. The reason was that some delay was occasioned in making out the commitment papers by the court, so that it was impossible to take the earlier train as the officers had intended to do. Lizzie awakened this morning to a realization that the hearing was at an end, judgment passed, and that, at the very least, 2 months of imprisonment and jail lay before her. Was found by friends who called earliest upon her in a state more nearly approaching collapse than at any time since her arrest. She was urged to refresh herself with some breakfast and did make the attempt, eating sparingly of a tempting repast and drinking a cup of coffee. The Reverend Mr. Buck was with her all the morning, as was also her sister Emma and the faithful friend Mary Brigham. They said and did all they could to comfort her, but under the constant and terrible strain to which she had been subjected, recognizing the end and that the end brought disaster, her nerves gave way. That was only because there were none there but her close friends whose sympathy she knew she could rely upon, who understood her, and before whom, therefore, she need not conceal her feelings. When summoned by the matron to get ready to take the train, her characteristic impassive, unemotional demeanor was assumed again, and she took the arm of the Reverend Mr. Buck and, attended by the Reverend Mr. Jubb and State Detective Seaver, went down the stairs and stepped into the carriage there waiting. There were but a half a dozen people standing in the street. A couple of police officers stood by the doors of the hack and ushered the party into it and closed the door. The passage of the carriage, with its drawn blinds, through the streets to the depot attracted no attention. It was not known that it contained the prisoner, whose guilt or innocence has been the topic of discussion by every individual in the city for the month past. Following this carriage was another containing Marshal Hilliard and 3 officers. The latter carriage reached the station first, and the officers took their stand in front of the ladies' entrance to the station and kept back the crowd which had gathered in considerable numbers. The train had not yet arrived, and the carriage with the closed blinds simply drew up to the curb and waited. Not until the train stood in the station did the door open. Detective Seaver, stepping out, led the party between the officers on guard and through the station into the car. They took the same relative positions as upon their previous journey. Miss Borden took a seat next to the window, with Mr. Buck in the seat with her, and Mr. Seaver behind. Mr. Jubb bade Lizzie goodbye, and that she be of good carriage, and returned to the platform, and immediately the train was underway. The crowd jostled and pushed in its effort to get a glimpse of the face at the window, but were left in a moment, gaping after the end of the train. Neither Emma nor any of Lizzie's female friends accompanied her. During the entire ride, scarcely a word was spoken by any of the party. Lizzie watched the passing panorama outside, lost in her own thought. The transfer from train to carriage through the station here was effected in the same rapid manner, and in a few minutes, Lizzie had crossed the threshold of the jail, and the world, for the time being, was barred against her, and she against the world. That was the Lizzie Edition, Part 4, The Great Borden Hearing Begun. True Crime Historian will conclude the Lizzie Edition in June 2018, the 125th anniversary of her famous trial. Theme music by David Severi with Pava Kuka on violin. Media management by Sean R. Jones. Production assistance by Emily Seimer Braun. Dedicated to Rachel Michelle. And I'm true crime historian Richard O. Jones, signing off for now.